Anything said in this podcast is our opinion, and while our aim is to explore the weird and wonderful world of humans in a non-judgmental way, we apologize if we don't always achieve this perfectly. It goes without saying that this podcast is for entertainment purposes and should not be taken as medical fact or in lieu of professional advice. Enjoy the show. Hello, I'm Emma.
And I'm Danny.
And welcome to our podcast, What's Not Wrong With Us?
Where we will share our interest in the human experience, from toxic overthinking to the art of complaining and everything in between. And most of all, what's not wrong with us?
Are there times when you feel out on your own, afraid that you're the only one? Something strange, something unique. Is it you?
Is it me?
Well, we're here to tell you what's not wrong with you. What's not wrong with us?
So, Emma, where do we find ourselves today? Yes. How are you, first of all?
I am really good, like good. Surprisingly good for the amount of Christmas shopping I did today.
And after our last episode of You Don't Want to Timestamp When These Are Recorded.
I know, but this is, well, see, I did think that we would have to confess that this is a Christmas episode because I am drinking wine, you know, on a whatever day this is, Monday night.
Monday night.
So that means it's Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good. How are you?
I am also good. I am. The wind down to Christmas is very, very close, like tangibly close at this point. And It's just, it's very that kind of feeling where Christmas goes from being kind of a date in the calendar and also becomes like a physical manifestation in your body where you're just sort of like, I need there to be the off. I need there to be the done.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. The alarm clocks are no longer relevant and time is a construct and your whole day is orbited around when are you eating next?
Yeah.
I need that.
Do you know a bit about how bad I am at doing the stopping for the holidays?
I do not, but I feel like it's not a huge stretch in terms of where I kind of see you currently.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's listened to my other podcast will know that
plug.
I have, which is called Thanks Therapy. It's on available on all the Spotify playlists. Is that I am terrible at stopping. So really what I do, especially at Christmas, is I just substitute one form of work for another form of work. Mm-hmm. And so I've been doing that since Friday, which is when I stopped work. So Saturday was getting things organised, cleaned the whole house. Sunday was helping my mum get her decorations done, doing some Christmas shopping. Today, all day today, Christmas shopping.
Busy day.
And the gym. So, you know.
At least you did the gym, though.
I know, yeah, that was a good part of the day. And I made a beautiful soup, unbelievable soup.
My day was spent at my laptop working under a blanket and a hot water bottle and many, many warm drinks, just trying to maintain some sort of base temperature. It wasn't, you know, corpse.
Yeah.
It was a lot today. It was, and it's not even that cold, but it's just, I don't know.
I know you got to chill, though. I definitely think that's what's, yeah, it got, once it gets into your bones, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just chatting beforehand about what we have planned for today.
Yes.
It's quite a mixed bag.
It is a mixed bag. And I think a real peaks and troughs in terms of levity, which I think is nice, though, at the same time, because the things that we can think are wrong with us will also have peaks and troughs in terms of levity. So it's reflective exactly of the subject matter that we're talking about.
Yes. Okay. Well, I think you should go first.
Oh, do you?
That's okay. My view. Yeah.
Okay. So what I am talking about today is the responses whenever you're confronted with danger. So for a long time, we believe that there was fight or flight. And then after that came freeze. And then Emma has recently just educated me that there's also fawn.
Mm-hmm.
So go research those in your own time. This is not that podcast. But I want to talk particularly about the freeze response, mainly because it's something that's just really, I don't know, it's just something that I've been thinking about a lot recently. And primarily it came off the back of, I was watching this new show on Paramount Plus called The Flatshare. It's fantastic if you haven't already watched it.
Right, okay.
It's about two characters who share a flat, but they share a one bed flat. And the basic premise is that the girl, who's the one I'm going to talk about, has the flat from 8 p.m. till 8 a.m. And then the other person who shares the flat has the same flat from 8 p.m. till 8 a.m. And they share a bed and they communicate via post-it notes and life ensues throughout.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's interesting.
The girl is played by Jessica Brown Findlay, who you'll recognize as, if you ever watched Downton Abbey, she was the middle sister who, spoiler alert, tragically died in one of the middle seasons. And she is fantastic in this. She plays a girl called Tiff, who, very complex character, and has a very emotionally abusive relationship with her ex-boyfriend. Many of these interactions that she has with him end in her exhibiting this freeze response. And I find myself, as you know, classic me, sort of watching these things and uber invested in these characters and who they are and what they are and what's happening to them. And I found myself at times whenever things were happening, just screaming at the TV for her to do something. So she wasn't running away and she wasn't, you know, fighting back. She just was stuck. She was just frozen by the stimulus of what he was doing.
So when, do you mean whenever they were still in the interaction?
Yes.
She was just frozen?
Yes.
Okay.
And right. I found, and I think because, again, from the observer looking in the, into this and seeing how, what was happening, it would be very quick to assume that the, what she was being presented with wasn't that serious. Like, it was him talking to her. It was just all very verbal. But I think it's because when you dig into that a wee bit more and sort of how she was perceiving that interactions, it actually kind of really got to the root issue that she had. So I think beyond the screaming at the TV and how challenged she was by it, there was more issue came out for me and then about all the awful things that she allowed to happen to her because of this freeze response. So in one scenario, she is in a very, apologies here, I'm giving a bit of a spoiler away, but it's endemic to the thing I'm trying to explain. So in one scene, she is at a big event, a public event, where she's been given an award for something, and she's on stage, and the ex-boyfriend has manufactured a scenario where this very overt kind of grand gesture of love is played out in front of all these public people, all of whom are her colleagues. He then makes his way to the stage. Well, I think he's like serenading her as it happens. She is completely frozen because she hasn't seen him in a while. Things have happened elsewhere. It's becoming more and more apparent that he is very toxic to her, but she doesn't know the full extent of his toxicity in the way that the audience do. And we've seen things and heard things that I won't give away at this time, but it's bad anyway. So he gets up onto the stage and professes his love for her and does a lot of that love bombing that's also kind of problematic when it comes to narcissists. And then proposes to her on stage. She freezes, doesn't respond, and he seizes the moment, whispers in her ear, "Don't ruin this for us, don't ruin this for me, don't make a fool of yourself," and then shouts broadcast across to the microphone, "She said yes, she said yes," and totally, and the whole, I mean, it's barely a minute of TV, but I'm like, oh my God, say something, just scream or lash out or do some sort of response to go back to this.
Yeah.
So I think my issue was that lack of kind of control being taken away and that kind of, you know, just allowing these things to happen. And, you know, she then retreats off stage. Other things happen. The story progresses without giving anything away. The ending is satisfying regardless. But to go back to kind of the, what this brought up, I think it's that, in that experience of that frozenness, it's very easy to be very hard on yourself about the non-action.
Oh yeah, totally.
It's very easy because I, as someone who is a freezer, I am someone who freezes in situations of high stress or in situations of turmoil or whatever. Retrospectively, it is very easy to kind of be like, why could you not do anything? Not even having to do, you know, the big thing, not having to do the, you know, the F you and this isn't what I want and all that. But even just walking away, even just remove, like even the little thing, it's the complete removal of anything is the issue that I have with that. So I suppose then I wanted to move on to that kind of that scariness that comes about around, for me anyway, is that removal of control. And I think without kind of trying to get too much into the psychology of all of this, I just wanted to try and talk out a wee bit of kindness to yourself. If you are find yourself in those situations where you are freezing.
I've got this. I know. I'm sitting on my psychological hands, so to speak.
Yes.
Because I know you don't want to get too much into the technicality, and I have talked about this topic at length and other things. But what I think is interesting about what you're saying is that how hard you are on yourself about this happening after it happens. And I think is, you know, you said you've experienced this, but I would say that a lot of people listening will have also experienced this. I think it's quite a common human experience that you will experience this particular type of freeze, because there's other ways that this manifests. This particular type of freeze where there's something significant or dramatic or really challenging happens and you freeze and you don't do anything. I think a lot of us have experienced that. And in fact, of the four Fs, what we used to think is that, or what people maybe misunderstand it as, is that you tend to be a fighter, or you tend to do flight, or you tend to do freeze, or you tend to do fawn. But actually, all of those are normal responses to threat that we have, and we all do as humans. We do all of those things at different times and, you know, as in response to different stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
So for that, in that respect, first of all, forgive yourself for being a normal human, you know, a normal animal, a normal mammal who has these reactions for a very useful purpose, you know, under the right circumstances, a life-saving purpose under the right circumstances. And arguably in that scenario that you're talking about, it's a life-saving situation.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever we talked about this before we started recording, and I said to you about the fourth F of fawn, because I have been known to do the fawn thing, and I do that mostly to men that I find threatening, and that is a protective action. And I think that in the same way the freeze is, and I think that character that you're talking about, she, it could be that in her interactions with that person, or in interactions with another person who was equally threatening, that she has found that the freeze thing protects her best.
Yeah.
Because if she reacts one way, another way, whatever way, she risks exacerbating the situation. And so, first of all, I think, forgive yourself, you know, for using a technique that you think might protect you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't beat yourself up about that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Hypothetical person in the world who's listening to this, and, you know, really don't. It's a completely natural response, and it's quite a good one often.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I thought was quite interesting is that although the word that we attach to this is freeze, in some cases it may be appear outwardly that it's a freezing, but inwardly in your brain, there's maybe a thousand things that's happening very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So what you said was a particularly good example where, you know, that character had made a very quick analysis of the situation, analysis of possible outcomes, and had realised that freezing in that scenario was a kind of safety response. In other cases, it's the freeze, for me anyway, is like a, again, that kind of analysis of the situation. And, well, I mean, I'm coupling this with the fact that I am a chronic overthinker and really analyse a lot of what happens around me, sometimes and most times to my detriment, because it's not actually as serious as all that. But in those overthinking moments, coupled with this freezing thing, it's almost as if, yes, outwardly, it appears that I'm kind of stuck in place, but inwardly I am trying to work out an outcome here as quickly as possible to then move past whatever this freezing is. And it's just, it's crippled a wee bit by the fear of whatever the negative outcome is that's kind of caused the freezing in the first place.
And often there isn't a good outcome. And so because your brain can't find the best way out of this scenario, it gets stuck. But sometimes also this response is completely unconscious. And when it's, oh God, I nearly got off my psychology hands. It's very difficult not to. Well, okay, I'll just say it. When it's pathologized, it's really is totally interfering with your life in that it's unconsciously happening, whether the threat is present or not, and is, you know, is really persistent and stopping, is interfering with your life, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think it's just, it is really hard to give yourself that grace. It is very hard to give that, you know, to not go down that really very aggressive path of there is something wrong with you, you can't deal with conflict, or there's something wrong with you, you can't deal with, you know, this You know, because sometimes for me anyway, it's happened in situations of high stress at work. So I can remember in my current job, we were launching service I managed or managed. And we were doing it, big public forum. There was about 150 people there. I have done a lot of public speaking in my life and in work, but this was the first time that the public speaking had been directly about something that I was completely in charge of.
Mm.
And it was the first time that I had as many eyes looking on me as we're looking at each other in terms of responsibility and who oversaw things. And I had a lot of responsibility, particularly on that day itself, in terms of the running order, the event itself. And I like event management. It's one of the things I like to think I'm good at.
Yeah.
But I distinctly remember going out into, it was held in Stormont, and upstairs in Stormont, there's those big sort of beautiful marble corridors, going down to this marble corridor and turning out into the window of this like interior courtyard, and just finding, I could not move. I was just completely frozen by the enormity of what I perceived the event to be and what the enormity of what I perceived the ramifications of the rest of that day to be. And I must have stood there for a solid sort of 60 seconds, just really like barely breathing, just having this like full crisis. And it was only that I kind of was able to A, have an overarching sense of, well, nothing's going to happen today if you don't leave this window that you've currently perched yourself at, go back to this room. But also just a little bit of grace around things could go wrong today. Things might, and probably, and actually things did go wrong that day, but they were so minor that I had blown up into so humongous, which caused the freezing in the first place, that the good stuff that actually happened that day, I had no concept that it was ever going to happen. Like the lovely things that were said and how well received the event was, I didn't even conceive that there was good things that could have happened that day, because my freezing had just eclipsed all of it. It was just, it's only going to be bad, and it's only going to be terrible, and it's only going to be the worst.
Yeah.
Insert other terrible words here. And yeah, I think it was just, it was a real lesson for me in terms of not allowing that kind of overthinking, freezing mentality to really kind of get traction in the mud, and just to sort of be like, well, let's just, you know, fact check what's exactly is happening here. Again, a bit of kindness, bit of forgiveness, bit of grace.
Yeah.
It has helped a lot. And I think it's also then to circle back to kind of the stimulus that brought about the conversation for this evening was I recently had not been on the outside looking in at a kind of freeze response happening. And obviously it was a drama and wasn't real or anything, but I think it's just because my first reaction was annoyance and just like, why are you not acting differently? Why are you being so stupid? Just do something, say something, move, you know? It very kind of quickly brought back to me how often when those particularly really challenging things are happening in your head, the most destructive force is yourself and the most destructive voice is yourself. Very rarely in those initial periods anyway, is it going to be one of the external forces that you're worried about the outcome happening. It's usually yourself being the most destructive in terms of actually something good happening in the long run.
Yeah. What you described there, that scenario is because freeze and all of the Fs, all of the four Fs manifest in different ways. And so you've described this character who's having a very instantaneous, probably unconscious reaction, which is to freeze as a protective factor for somebody who's clearly very threatening. And then you had a situation where you were dealing with a very challenging situation, a very difficult situation. Difficult only in terms of the pressure and the responsibility that was weighing on you. And so that was a slightly slower release version of the freeze, right? So you think, I am getting overwhelmed here. I have to go away and stop. And once you do, you can't, it's very hard for you to get yourself out of it. And you had to do some, you know, self-talking coping techniques to get yourself out of it again. And then another way that it can manifest, which is how I've talked about it in the past, is that, and this happens a lot with young people today, but it happens a lot with people who experience depression, is that they go into kind of like a long-term freeze. So like somebody who continually sits on their phone, or somebody who continually just watches the same program over and over and over again, somebody who can't fit, you know, stays in one place, stays in their bed, all of that is sort of a manifestation of freeze as well. And it is because they've got the message that the world is scary and the world is scary, and, you know, and they think, well, actually, if I just only deal with this stimulus, the scrolling on the phone, or if I just deal with this program that I've watched 100 times before, and if I just stay in my bed, if I don't move, and if I don't go out and experience, then I won't face any of those threats that I have perceived or built up in my head to be in existence. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of ways that it can, it's, you know, but again, there's, it's, that's because we have the capacity for that in our minds. That's because that's how we're built. And I think what you were saying about earlier is that if we, once we recognize that, so what I beat myself up about the fawning situation that I did, because it's against my feminist ideals to fawn at arrogant men. I beat myself up about it. And then I realized, but this is a self-protective technique that you've learned because of how men have treated you in the world. And you've realized that you can, you, they will leave you alone, and they won't, you know, treat you sometimes horrifically if you pander to them a bit. If you fawn, then you get, you can get on with your life a bit, you know, easier. And so I had to forget. So I think the understanding allows you to forgive yourself about it, is what I'm, is the point I'm making there. Because understanding the phrase, why you do it, the fact that it's, first of all, it's a natural response, it's where it comes from. And then the fact that, well, this is how I'm trying to respond to this scenario. You know, it's not because I'm defective or I'm doing it wrong or I'm responding wrongly. I'm trying to respond, and I have to give myself the grace and forgiveness that, you know, I should give myself.
The grace and forgiveness that others would so freely give
you. Yeah, of course. Yeah, your sister or your best friend would never say to you, you know, oh, you're an idiot for not doing something.
My sister might.
Actually, sisters probably would, wouldn't they? But I think, you know, you're shouting at the screen, but it's because you want her to be okay. You're invested in her. I don't think it's because you're, you know, like judging her for what she's doing. I think it's just because you've invested in this character and you want her to the best for her.
I think so. And I think as well as that, once I got past that initial kind of angry, annoyed feeling about it, there was a lot then I just immediately started to identify with. And then it was very quickly transferred to being annoyed at myself because, you know, of situations I've been in where I wish I'd spoken back. I wish I had, you know, said some really quippy, quick kind of, you know, very vindicating response to something, or in some kind of lasting way, really just hit them where it hurts in that moment, cause just try and deflect off whatever it was that I was put in a position where I felt frozen by. I think it was, I mean, I definitely, the TV show is not that deep, and I've turned it, it's really deep introspection of my life. But I think it's another way in which, you know, the world and the universe reminds you of those kind of lessons that you hopefully as you grow up and learn that you should be taking with you, because they make you a better equipped person for the world. They make you better equipped to deal with whatever comes along, because there will be situations in the future, because it's hardwired into me. That's the response, where I will either do that again, or hopefully will start to do that again, realize that I'm doing it, and be able to quicker institute those better responses to it. So it's, I feel a bit more able to manage.
I think we do come across situations where we think, I think I've grown, and this is how I'm going to segue into my topic for the day. But that observation doesn't come for a while in this story. But basically, I wanted to talk about how I have no sense of direction. I have a really, really bad sense of direction. And I live in quite a small city, so it's grand. I mostly go to and from the same places all the time. I know my way around, so I don't get lost, right? But I was recently in Italy, in a small town in Italy, and I had to navigate between the hotel and the university where the conference was being held. And so luckily there was other people staying in the hotel, and I was able to walk with them. when I tried to walk myself, I realized I don't really have any idea of, I have like so little idea of the, even the direction that I thought, no, I do know. So I just need to find this particular square that has this statue in the middle of it. Right, okay, off I go. Walk for a good 10 minutes and solidly in the wrong direction until I realize I have never seen any of this before. And I think, am I going to get lost in this town? And the problem, I had no roaming data. I don't know why. I had the data to use available to me. I just couldn't get it operational on my phone. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have the internet, so I couldn't use a map. Well, occasionally I could get it working. So I got it working enough that I was able to realize I had walked 10 minutes in the wrong direction and turned myself around and just went back to the conference center. And then there was some people walking and I managed to walk with them. And I can't tell my left from my right. Right. Now, I know when I say this, a lot of people go, that's nonsense, or you can, or... But what I mean by that, and I know other people that have this, right, it's a legitimate thing. Yes, I can put my two hands out and I know my left hand has my ring on it. Mm-hmm. And I can do like a writing action if I'm trying to think of which hand is my right hand.
Yeah.
Right.
Listener, she just did a writing action there as that was happening just to vindicate that that was right.
Most people don't have to do that.
Yes.
Right. Most people, apparently, according to other people, it's automatic. And even when they're young, like, so my 14-year-old can tell his left from his right. Once he learnt it, it was internalized. No more problems. But I would regularly, you know, use one hand and be indicating the wrong direction for people to go. And so I don't have a good sense of direction. I still get lost. I'm 40. I nearly got myself lost in a town. You know, sometimes I think I make the wrong directional decisions.
Mm.
I mean, getting off the train at the wrong stop, at the like a literal middle of nowhere stop, was not a great move. No. I don't know that it's to do with my sense of direction. It was just a bad decision.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely the sense of direction plays a part whenever I'm having to try and navigate a new place. And the reason why this came up to talk about was because
such a great preamble. All right, go.
I was sitting the other night and Marty had gone out, and it has been very cold here, listeners, like ice -1, -2, ridiculous temperatures for us. We never get that, really.
There was about an inch of ice on the footpath outside Emma's house, and I did a wee sort of Torval and Dean moment out the front.
Yeah, lots. Hannah fell like 6 or 7 times this season. Yeah,
it's really bad.
So I thought, I will get some groceries delivered. I will get Deliveroo to bring me a couple of bags of groceries. It means I will have things for the kids for the morning. That's a great idea, and I won't have to leave the house. So I order the groceries. Deliveroo tells me the driver's on their way, and then all of a sudden I get a phone call. So I know it's bound to be Deliveroo is lost, because I'm looking out my front window and there's no cars anywhere. So the guy answers the phone and he says, I'm at the bus stop. Right. And I say, oh, right, on the X, insert name of road near me, road. And he said, I'm at the bus stop. Do you see me?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no. Is the bus stop on the road? Is it the bus stop on the road? Right. And he's on speakerphone, so he's difficult to understand. He's not really understand me. And so I realized that on my delivery app, it says my address properly, but the little pin sort of looks like it's on the front of the road where there happens to be a bus stop. Right. But he just keeps saying, I'm at the bus stop, right? And so I think to myself, I have a fair idea of what bus stop he's at, so I will direct him from here. So I say, you have to drive forward and take the first left and you will be in my street, and then drive round, and I live in the middle of the street, number 19. And I repeat my address, 19 Streety Street, Crescent.
So again, right? Listener, just for context of this, without giving away addresses here, Emma lives on like a D-shaped sort of roadway off the main road where this person was. But at the front of this roadway, there is also a little section that cuts across. So there's houses the whole way around the width of the V.
Yes,
the
D is a very good description.
Chunk
yeah.
of footpath at the front of it.
Yeah. So I was worried about that because I thought, oh, he's going to get confused and he's just going to drive into that bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I, to this day, do not know where he was because he then said to me, I can see, I'm going to have to make up a name because people are going to be able to tell where I live. I can see the shop cover. The shop cover? And I say, oh, cafe cover. Yes, cafe cover. That's, yeah. Are you facing, are you on the same side of the road as cafe cover? Are you on the other side of the road as cafe cover? And I don't know that he couldn't answer that question, right? So I don't know where he was. And he said, I'm on the street of cafe cover. What do I do when I'm on that street? And I said, well, I'm thinking to myself, I actually don't know where you are really. But if you're on the street I think you're on, you drive down to that, then you take a right. And then when you get down to the bottom of that street, you take a left and you drive around the corner. And for some reason, we got into an argument about that.
Oh, God.
Right? So it was back and forth about, what do I do now? Do I go right? Do I go left? And so at this point I said, see, to be honest, dude, I actually don't know where you are. So if you're where I think you are, you go right and then you go left. But you could be anywhere on the planet. Like, I honestly don't know where you are. And he was getting more and more frustrated. And he wasn't attacking me, but it's unusual for a stranger to shout at you.
Yes.
On a phone call. So he was saying, but cafe cover, where do I go from there? And I was like, oh. And so I said, see, to be honest, you need to get a map on your phone. Like, just hang up, put the map on your phone, and the map will take you to 21 Streety Street Crescent or wherever it is I live, dear listener.
Streety Street Crescent.
So just get the map on your phone. Yeah. Like a map. This conversation that we're having is deeply frustrating. And, you know, so eventually I see this car slowly driving down the street and I say, I can see you. I can see you. You're on the right street. Keep going. Keep going. He then nearly drives past the house, so he's sort of slowing down and I'm going, I'm looking at you in the window, no, other side of the road. So I get my shopping, I give him a tip because it's Christmas, but you know,
you're a better person than I.
The frustration that I had was I was actually in that conversation, I was starting to lose my mind because it became like, What are directions? Like, what is left and right? How does it matter if I don't know where you are? Like, I could have been sending him in the opposite direction to me. He could have been going on the other side of the road. He could have been pointing away from cafe cover that we know and love. Great cafe cover.
Love cafe cover.
It's literally a word that I saw on the wall. That
I was like, what about that made you think cover?
So. And then afterwards I thought, well, you know, people previously have told me that I'm very bad at giving directions. So was this me? Like, did I, you know?
So I'll be honest with you, and this may be a hard truth, Emma.
Yeah.
However, while you were telling that story, in my mind I was trying to envisage all these lefts and rights and things.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think it's a personal critique of you, but I think it's just, I feel like there was other words you could have given him to really help kind of say where he was. Now, by no means am I saying that you like are to blame for him, because I guarantee there was a lot of it where had he taken out a map, had he just put in your address, had he gone to your address rather than where the pin was, all of these things. But at the same time, I feel like, as you say, if you don't have an innate sense of direction in you, it's not something that naturally comes to you.
Yeah.
It's not something that you can naturally just pull on to say, oh, I can understand or visualize where this is in relation to me or in relation to space or whatever.
Yeah. And it just suddenly felt so useless. I was like, no, it just was totally, it was so arbitrary. I was like, well, you take a right, then a left, but also maybe you don't. Like, you know, maybe you'll turn up, maybe you won't. Are we going to keep being on this phone call?
Because the bottom line was just like, I would like you off the phone now, please.
Are we going to keep arguing about where you are and how I can direct you to me? Or could we try a different approach that doesn't involve me repeatedly saying, well, yeah, you go right and then left. But I do think those words were kind of useless. And, you know, they were, but I didn't know what else to do, how else to direct him. If I could have said, when you get to the large lion statue, then you turn left and then at the huge monkey puzzle tree.
Yes.
But there's no, it's just little streets that all look identical to each other.
I also think it wasn't helped by the fact that he could not clearly tell you where he was.
No.
So there was very hard to orientate. Like, the you were basically going off an assumption around you picking out from his clues as to where he was. And then he was trying to piece together what you had said to work out how he would get round.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was a lose-lose in that scenario.
Totally. Which, and you know, I kind of forgave him for it, but I thought, you know, if you're like, if you, this is what I'm saying about when you are at a place where you can't navigate. So I was able, I know the main road that I live on and I know the streets and I know the different shops. I, you know, I know all those things and I know how to get from the main road to my house and I can direct somebody that way. But when I was in Italy, I was just like in another sandstone coloured street, you know, in another little street with cobblestones. Like, he obviously doesn't know this area.
No.
And so he couldn't tell me where he was in relation to the main road because he didn't really know anything about the main road, you know. And so that's what's wrong with me, is that some people I know just can, they have a kind of sense of direction. They, or once they do a walk once, they're like, oh, I can now find my way from a hotel to a, I mean, it was a 15 minute walk at best.
Yeah.
Probably more like 12. There was several landmarks along the way.
Monkey puzzles and otherwise.
Yeah. There was a big statue, main square. There was a street you can miss, but then there was also lots of other little forked off streets. And
I think as you were talking there, I was like thinking, what's my sense of direction like? Have I got good sense of direction? And I initially was about to be like, yes, I have a great sense of direction. And I was going to recount you with all these stories of how I've really well navigated things and how I'm that person who's like, orientate the map to the direction that we're looking at. And, you know, Duke of Edinburgh quickly starts seeping back over you again and you're like, move the map and things. But at the same time, there has been many times where I've really gotten my own way direction-wise and really gotten my own way in terms of trying to convince myself that a road entryway is the road entryway that I needed to go down because it has this tree and that bush and this thing and that. Mm. And I have, you know, as the crow flies, had a sense in myself that I have been in the same amount of time from such place to such place and therefore I turn right now.
Yeah.
That's not a real thing. That's the me thing that I've created to try and make sense of a construct around distance and time that I just don't have enough of a bearing on.
Yeah.
Whereas other people, like, again, my dad is, you know, you could show him a road once and he'd be like, this will take 64 minutes to get there and we will travel at 45 miles per hour and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's just in him. And I think there is, there's definitely people who have a real gift for it. Just as you were talking about left and right as well, the way I always remember it is the L of your left hand.
Yeah. I know. People always say that to me, Danny. A lot of people say that to me. And I am aware that
touching salted wood.
No. I can see that makes an L, right? But I know that other people don't have to hold their two hands up in front of them to tell which is left and right.
And if you do, you do. You know what?
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with you.
Oh, thanks very much. Because, you know, I do think it's that thing of, since you know, I know that some people can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think, well, I am defective in some
way. Yeah, it always actually comes back to you, I am defective.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I kind of wanted to be like them to come up with a dyspraxia, dyslexia type diagnosis. If you can't tell your left from your right, have you also noticed that you're not that great at maths? And you know, some other thing that also was true for me. And then I could be like, yes,
it's that thing's fault. It's not mine.
Can I get 15 extra minutes of my exam, please?
Oh my goodness, exactly.
But Marty's my husband, dear listener. He is good at directions in a way that I'm not, and then also bad at them in other ways.
Okay.
So what happens is whenever we go places together, we will always get lost. We always get lost when we go places together. So we went to Donegal. We weren't that long together, and we were trying to find a cottage on a hill in Donegal, which, for anybody who doesn't know, that's literally like a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, very much so.
Right.
Take the fourth right after the boat and the bath in the middle of the field and you'll find it there.
We had some directions, but once we went over the border, my phone's really not that good at roaming.
There's a lot of phone related issues here.
So we got really lost and we ended up having to like call into some kind of farmhouse place.
Nice.
And they drove us to the correct turn off. They were trying to describe it to us, and we must have looked so totally lost that they were like, I have to go into town anyway, I'll drive down and then you can, I'll show you where the turn off is. And we did that, and that's the only way we found that cottage, honestly. And then we got lost in Wales, and it's all right if we're not like on a a real time, which we often are, because we're often also running late.
Mm-hmm.
So together, unfortunately, like, it's, you know, we're not fixing each other's directional problems.
I also feel like it is much easier to get lost than it is to know your way. It is much easier, because the knowing your way aspect, I find, takes an awful lot more kind of conscious awareness, whereas getting lost, especially on any kind of journey or route that you have a bit of confidence in, is much, much easier, because you're distracted, or you're thinking about other things, or I am terrible for the, I've been driving for an hour and could not remember a single thing that's happened, how did I get here thing. So about three... about 2-3 weeks ago, my sister and her husband-to-be were coming home for a wedding, and it was terrible fog. We were collecting from the airport, and we were going up to my parents' house up the north coast. And the way that you normally go from the airport is up through sort of 3 or 4 small towns, and then you come out at my parents' house. But I, in my wisdom and great driver that I am, was like, no, we shan't do that. Instead, we will go back the way we came, go to the motorway, because it'll be gridded and it'll be safe because the roads were icy, etc. This bloody ice really has impacted so much of my life recently. And I have done the motorway road home hundreds of times, daytime, nighttime, all the times. I could tell you it like the back of my hand. I know the bumps in the road, the whole nine yards. I came on this road from a different exit that I never normally come on from, driving along the motorway, and somewhere along the line ended up in Tunbridge, which is nowhere close to where I needed to be, and had this really like, I am very lost and don't know where I am. Don't know how I got here. And in Tunbridge, there is this kind of very famous, the Tunbridge itself, which is all lit up, and it was opened by Mary McAleese. And it's this sort of, and I saw it sort of coming over the horizon towards me and was like, oh my God, where are we? How did we get here? How has this happened? And my sister in the car beside me, like, oh, we'll work it out. And then took the most convoluted route home that incorporated all of these tiny, tiny C-class roads that have no grit on them, which was the absolute antithesis of what we were trying to achieve. So the reason I tell this story is that the ability to get lost is within us all.
Yes,
and
that's true.
The, again, the grace of forgiveness is not always in us all either. But yeah, the reason I was telling that very long story was just to say, again, even people who think they know their way around everything can still get lost.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I feel better about it. I do feel better for Sharon, but, you know, I've felt like an idiot for quite some time now.
And you really want an ism to hold and hit your horse to.
If I could just be diagnosed with something then, it would justify it all. as seriously as some people, when you say you don't know your left from your right, they do look at you like you've got two heads, like you're a baby or whatever. Like,
I always think as well, there's something about, not to blow your head up here, but there is something about people who struggle with those things that people are like, oh, that's really simple. Like, why do you not know how to do that? they have really incredible intelligence in other ways.
Thanks. I do think that's true for me, for sure.
I don't want to embarrass her, but there's someone else in my life who can't read a clock.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, actually, like an analog clock, if you were to point it to her, uh-huh. and this person is not a child, she is a fully grown adult. She cannot read a clock. Every time she looks at clock, she's like, it's just movement and doesn't make any sense to her. And she's been talked through it and what the hands all mean, just no ability.
Mm.
And she is, I mean, incredibly intelligent in other ways. And I think it's one of these things where sometimes the brain is just like, we don't have room for this. No.
Yeah.
With no space. No space for this. What other people regard as a basic thing. We're making room for something else.
We're not doing that, actually. No, thank you. No.
That shelf is completely full of other important things.
If this was a psychology podcast, though, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to wait. Let me put my warden hat on here and just keep track.
Well, you know, sometimes for example, I missed a week or a couple of weeks in school in P3 when we were learning the time. And it took me longer to learn how to tell the time because I wasn't there for that fundamental thing. I came back and they all had these clocks. And they were like, and I was like, what? And it took me ages, but I did get it because I have been able to work it out. But, you know, if there was something more significant that happened in your life at the time of something like that, more than just you were off sick with measles or whatever it was I had, you know, then sometimes that could impact it. But this isn't a psychology podcast, so there's no point even bringing that up.
Skim.
Okay, right. Tell me about the weird and wonderful world of TikTok.
TikTok of the week.
And what you have found.
So listeners will be happy to hear that I have moved away from my catalogue of placented various TikToks onto other idioms. So my TikTok of the week this week, again, linked for your viewing pleasure attached with this, is this individual. I'm trying to actually find the... I'm going to try and watch it here.
Handle?
So
is that what we say
not
on
the
TikTok?
Handle. I'm trying to find out what the chemical is that he's ingesting.
Oh, right. Well, I Googled it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. So I will tell you because I've all got it all looked up and all.
Oh, there we go. Sorry, I found it. Apologies for the dead air in the medium there. So basically, this TikToker is a gamer. He is going live on YouTube and... Before he goes live on YouTube, he drinks 10 fluid ounces of magnesium citrate liquid laxatives,
which is something.
Yes, so he drinks this and then basically just, I don't know, allows the cards to fall as they may as he plays the
game.
Sees
how long he gets to play the game before
his insides become his outsides. And then without being hypergraphic about, he then has many other videos where him sitting on the toilet, sort of calling every deity he can to him for aid because he is just having a terrible time. So I suppose I wanted to kind of just talk about that example is a pretty good one of, this kind of idea of like, I don't know, self-flagellation for the benefit of entertainment.
So when you first sent me this, the first thing I thought was, oh, this is one of these people who, you know, does a thing that's abusive to their body as performance, you know, that's the kind of thing. And then I continued to watch it and I was like, well, he's doing something that's arguably quite mild. The main thing that it's doing is inconveniencing him. Now, I don't think that now because he does it all the time and that is definitely... definitely bad for your digestive system to take that amount of laxatives all the time. And I think people have died from overusing laxatives, usually because they have an eating disorder, but I don't know which were the, you know, where the thing that's causing the death is coming from. And because it can like rid your body of nutrients and all that kind of stuff. So that setting that aside for a moment, like the health kind of thing of this, so I thought, oh, it's that type of person who's like, oh, I'll, you know, drink this thing or I'll, you know, set my hair on fire or it's this kind of performance art where you're kind of doing something that's sort of harmful for to yourself for content. And then as I watched it, I thought there's something else going on here. Like, does he think is it because it's funny or, you know, did you watch the video where he explains why he does it?
So,
because it's not an explanation. I just want to preface that it's not an explanation.
I'd have to admit I have not watched an explanation video, mainly because I think out of context this video has so much more gravitas, because it's just sort of like, good grief, like what on earth? I suppose I actually kind of was wondering there as you were talking, like, is this, you know, very destructive? I mean, you use the word performance art, I suppose, so we'll go down that road. Mm. This performative, very sort of self-harmful, or, you know, very disruptive to your day activity. Is this kind of like the next evolutionary step in what has been, like, you know, a history of people doing things to themselves for the purposes of entertainment that has been happening for a long time now? And this is just the next version of it that we're watching. This is, you know, hurt myself for the purposes of viewing pleasure and discomfort myself for the purposes of viewing pleasure. Because I suppose the thing is, you know, this person is doing multiple times, so he's not doing enough irreparable damage that he's decided to stop. He's, you know, doing it more than...
I mean, he might have to.
He might have to, but for now, your man is flat to the mat and flat to the toilet as well.
Yeah.
So do you think this is just that next evolution things? Because, you know, for a while there, people who, like, did things like swallowed swords, or people who, you know, did all those horrible things with bugs and things where they were, you know, like you see it on I'm a Celebrity where they eat live insects. Mm-hmm. That's another gross thing. Yeah. So is this, like, you know, turned up to 10 version of that?
I think in terms of that entertainment spectrum between, like, eating fire or swords and eating bugs and bull testes, it's on the end of the, it's on the people going, oh, gross, why would you kind of do that sort of thing?
So just for context as well, and just the second TikTok, which is the...
You want to talk about that now?
Well, I just think, because now sort of thinking about it, it kind of all comes under a nice sort of theme of this, of doing things that I think kind of entice conversation, which is what we're doing currently.
Okay, go for it.
Which is another guy who said he was going to eat a PB&J. I'm only laughing just because... to do something so benign for what it actually was is humorous.
It was so,
so PB&J obviously is your peanut butter and jelly, or peanut butter and jam. His PB&J is pineapple. The B is bull testicle, and the J is jerky. Mm-hmm. And then he comments, "Oh, because I would never eat peanut butter." And I was like, "Yeah, that's not the weirdest thing that's happening in this video."
Mm-hmm.
So then that's went me down a path of the people who are now widespread eating various, and I should mention also raw animal offal and part. Yes. And I think as well as that, it's, you know, because whenever you go down this road, like, there's many cultures across the world that eat all of the animal, and they eat, you know, head, brains, eyes, entrails, liver, rah, 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 rah. I think the division I see in this is that, A, the single part that they're only really eating is this testicle part. It strikes me a wee bit like they're trying to, I don't know, sublimate the testosterone or something out of it into their own bodies. But also, it does feel a bit performative. Feels a bit like 100%. This is, you know, the most prolific part of the animal because it's where sperm comes from.
Yeah.
And I'm going to eat it.
Well, I mean, I think... the thing is that if you are eating bull testicles on your own time and not filming it for TikTok, that's one thing. But the fact that you're filming it for TikTok, you're making a statement of a kind. And I think while these are both kind of performative acts, they're both motivated very differently, I think. I think the gamer guy is kind of like probably quite a harmless... oh, I nearly said idiot, but that's too judgmental for this podcast.
It really
isn't it,
is.
Danny?
Judgmental! We need like a siren or something.
Yeah, we'll do an alert. But, you know, what I mean by that is, like, so his explanation for what he was doing was he just likes it. It's just fun. Some people drink alcohol. He likes to drink laxatives. He has a cupboard full of laxatives, several cupboards, in fact. He stocks up on them. And some people comment saying, that's just water in that. That's been out of stock for a while. And he'd gone, oh, do you mean my laxative cupboards? Do you mean my stash of laxatives? So he's always trying to prove that he's definitely drinking the laxatives.
Yeah.
And then the other aspect to that performance is the fact that it, for some reason, he feels like it's okay to film himself on the toilet, which for me is a step too far. The other guy is making a different statement, like...
yeah.
So you sent me that video. He's eating it. It looks like it could be like a brioche roll, but actually it's an enormous bull testicle.
Yeah,
with pineapple in between. And texturally, it just looks like, I don't know why anybody would want to eat that. But he was aggressively kind of suggesting that this was obviously the right thing to do, to eat like this instead of eating PB&J.
Yeah.
And I didn't like his vibe, Danny. I didn't like that vibe. I felt like there was probably a lot of political stuff that he and I would have disagreed with that was underlying the bull testicle thing.
Yeah.
The bull testicle thing seemed like the tip of the iceberg, really.
So have you heard about the guy on TikTok, the Liver King?
No.
So the Liver King rose to fame there. He is an incredibly, incredibly muscular man who, you know, wanders around barefoot, bare-chested all seasons of the year. I don't think him and a hairdresser have had a conversation in maybe a year and a half.
Okay.
And he is very prolific about the in eating of raw animal products, particularly things like testicle, liver, as his name would suggest, spleens, and because he thinks that there's some sort of attributes you get from this that you only get from these aspects and eating them in this raw way.
Worms would be one of those aspects that you would definitely get.
Yeah, maybe, yep. But he goes further in that his whole family eat like this and his whole family ingest this way. And then for a long time, he credited his incredible physique with this ingesting.
Well, he's certainly eating a lot of protein. So,
oh my goodness, yes. And then he's now inspired a following of people who will go out of their way to... the testicles particularly, and there's just seems a real subsection of men who, and I say men because it's only really men that I've seen on TikTok doing this, who are eating testicles.
Yeah.
And as you say, quite aggressively. Mm. Like, I can't imagine they taste good because A, they're cold. B, there is a obvious sheen on the product. Yeah. So there's a slime to it as well.
Yeah.
And as for taste, I mean, it does not taste like steak. I will guarantee you that much. It does not taste like an animal product that I have had ever.
Yeah.
So I imagine it's quite salty.
Yeah.
And just knowing what a testicle's purpose is when the animal is whole, it really brings into question a kind of, what is your drive to ingest that beyond the sheer kind of performativeness of it?
There does seem like there's a masculine,
I think, masculine
side to it for yeah.
To circle,
or maybe a toxic masculine thing side to it.
Interesting. We should go down this path, Emma, because to circle back to the Liver King, it has recently come to the light that his incredible physique is not down to bull testicles, but to an incredible amount of human growth hormone that he was ingesting.
Yeah.
And steroids and God knows what else that he's putting into his body. And he's had to come out and apologize and say, but the testicles help also, but the testicles really help also. And the fact you have a bicep growing out of your eyeball is nothing to do with anything else.
But it's I think what links these things, as well as the performance thing, is the, you know, putting into your body.
Mm.
And I think it's that thing of, like, you've got one little dude drinking, mass quantities of laxatives, and you've got somebody else who's putting in, you know, all these raw, awful parts that we wouldn't necessarily eat. And the first reaction that I have is, what are the consequences of that, right? And so I'm sure they have masses of, you know, click link in bio to find out all the benefits and all that kind of stuff. But it also does sound like the start of an episode of House, or the end of an episode of House, where they find out that this person's been eating raw liver for 2 years,
riddled with worms,
and that's why they're riddled with worms, have overdosed themselves on vitamin A,
scurvy.
Yeah, so like whenever you're pregnant, you shouldn't eat liver because it's too high in certain things, and there is a risk that if you eat in a way, you know, we've done a lot of different crazy things with our diets over the years, but we've pretty much come down to the thing of, you should eat a range of foods. Fruit and vegetables should form a good part of it. We know that because fiber is really good for your gut, and your gut is like a central part of your health. You should eat protein. You should have vitamins and minerals. We've kind of narrowed it down to that.
Yeah.
You know, do what you will with this information beyond that.
And food pyramids are available from your dietitian.
And so I think that, you know, going, oh no, actually what you need is a bunch of raw meat and not but leaving not meat anything
specifically
else.
Awful. I think it's the fact that it's not raw steak. It's not like steak tartare or something. Mm-hmm. It's raw offal. And then further to that, it's raw offal that isn't really eaten other than, you know, for performative reasons. So I would see through it, you know, for example, Inuit cultures eat pretty much the entirety of the animal whenever they slaughter them because of the relationship they have with the land and with the relationship that they have the animals and the beliefs around the use of that fullness of that creature, right? Yeah. There is a lot of tradition and culture around that. These young men do not have that cultural mm-hmm. background behind them to do it. And particularly people like Liver King, who are then ascribing it to some sort of, you know, you can be a better man if you do this.
Yeah.
It's a very, like, performative kind of, you know, I'm the best man because I not only have testosterone that I make myself, but I'm also eating a bull's testosterone as well.
Yeah.
Therefore, I am Omni-Man.
Yes. I would also, one of the things that I thought about when I thought about Liver King is that maybe Liver King is wealthy and has a really good butcher connection. And so he can get these items fresh, because my concern is that people walking into their average butcher and asking for some of these parts are not going to necessarily know the level of freshness of them.
Yeah.
And whenever I did eat meat, I struggled with the freshness of meat all the time because it spoils much quicker than other products.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just be concerned that given the lack of demand for offal, that there's a risk that you're going to consume some offal.
Oh, yeah.
Don't diet.
Awfully off, oh. Awful.
Really awful, awful.
Mm. Never have I said awful that many times.
I know.
Or better yet, sweetbreads.
Yeah, sweetbreads. Well, actually, funnily enough, I'm listening to a podcast at the minute, and it's about a place in Missouri where they have these particular type of giant fish, and there's a whole culture around snaring them at a particular mm-hmm. time of the year. Paddlefish, they're called. They're like really prehistoric, and they live to, and they grow like 6 feet.
Whoa.
And they live to like 80 years and all this kind of
big
stuff.
Fish.
And so they have this festival every now and again. And one part of the festival is like all these guys get together in a bar and eat testicles.
Okay.
Cooked though, I think. They're cooked as sweetbreads.
Okay. Yes.
I think, you know, sweetbreads is the polite term. Or the term for when they're cooked,
for
maybe.
Animal
or
innards.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with these people, but there might be health-wise if they're not a bit more careful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that will, you know, that will make itself clear to them.
What do you think is in this that attracts men to this idea of doing something? Because I would put money on the fact that the men who are doing this did not grow up eating these things. So they have seen something online and are drawn to it in some way. So I'm just curious, like, what do you think draws men to eating testicle and then recording it and putting it on TikTok?
Well, I'm sure there's lots of people who eat it and don't record it and put it on TikTok.
Yes.
But I do think that we've sort of touched on the idea that there's a highly masculine culture around meat already, around being a carnivore and eating meat. And that
barbecue king vibe.
Barbecue king vibe. And, you know, oh, you could do with a good steak and all that kind of stuff. That has a very masculine vibe around it. And we know that there are some movements in the male world globally that are feeling very disenfranchised. Rightly or wrongly so, they're feeling disenfranchised, and that there's a reaction then back towards that. And some of it might be filtering into testicles. I mean, certainly a lot of it's related to testicles, but in terms of eating giant raw bull testicles, I think.
And honestly, listener, watch the thing. These things are not small.
No.
They are, I would say, probably about 3 inches long and maybe like 2 to 3 inches around, a big ovular gelatinous looking mass that he eats cut in half with pineapple and jerky in the middle.
And bites into it. That's why I thought it was a bap, and I thought, what, you know, sorry, a bap is Northern Irish for roll.
Roll, bun.
A bread roll.
Bread roll, or
a burger bun.
Yes.
Just for anybody who's not from here and wonders why I'm saying bap all the time.
Yeah. So, Emma.
Yeah.
Segue off this, please, into our next door segment. Because I just can't talk about testicles anymore.
I know. Do you know what?
I've reached the apex of my testicle tectonic ability.
I've never been so glad to not have to come up with answers as I am. You know, because we've sort of said that we... you said something earlier about being a chronic overthinker, and I'm an overthinker. And I think that's the whole vibe of this thing, is that we are coming across a topic that we have... done some overthinking on, and then we're sharing it on this podcast. But to not have to come up with an answer is great for me, because normally I have to do that.
Well, I like to think of this as the two of us are sitting at a coffee shop cafe, cafe cover, if you will, and are just people watching this happening around us. But instead of it happening around us, it's happening online, or it's happening in our lives, or it's things we're aware of, and we're just chatting about it. Have a chat and just seeing where it takes us to.
Yep.
Did you want to talk about it?
So originally we were going to record tomorrow, and I did have something that I was going to do about next door. I was going to do a sort of a found poem from things in next door, but I didn't have it prepared. And so I was going to just do it on the fly, but I can't get my app to load.
Can I... pose something to you that I thought was an interesting next door find that I found the other day?
Oh my god, have you got a next door find?
Well, just because I thought it was interesting. So, and future Danny, whenever you have to go look for this, I am going to try and screenshot the thing that I had today so that you can find it to link it. Basically, it was this person who came on to say that she was looking for a cleaner, and she wanted the cleaner to come for an hour a day, 5 days a week. And the response to this was pretty much unilaterally, cleaners do not do an hour a day, 5 days a week.
Yeah.
You will get a cleaner for a minimum of 2 hours, as that's the going rate. And I thought it was just a really, because I thought her request was very, you know, benign and sort of just, I'm just inquiring, I have a house and I want help with it being cleaned, da da da. And I think it kind of talks back to that thing that we talked about before, where the aggressiveness of the return did not marry the exchange that it started off with. Like, it was like, cleaners, clean, minimum of 2 hours. I'm sorry, I did not know that there was a cleaners union who had mandated that across, like, all cleaners across the world. Because I'm pretty sure there is cleaners out there who would decide, actually, an hour is what I want to
if
do today.
If you pay for me to go once a day, I'll do that.
Yes.
Like, and I do think that that is the case in reality, and a cleaning firm would probably tell you that. But this is, I knew exactly how people would react when you said what the person asked for, because that's how people react on Nextdoor to stuff. So they overreact to things, but especially if somebody says, could I have somebody to clean my house for an hour a day, 5 days a week? But that little voice in your head that says, I mean, that's a lot of cleaning to pay for. Like, can you not do some of that cleaning yourself? Or... like, do you really need an hour a day clean? Mm-hmm. Are you made of money? That little voice in your head is the shouting voices of next door. So everybody just comes on to be like, I just pick up in the morning and then I clean my bathroom in the evening and then I do this and then I hoover and I wouldn't need a cleaner an hour a day, 5 days a week. And then you've got people going, no cleaner would ever agree to these terms. How dare you think that
the subtext of that being, what is wrong with you that you cannot A, either clean yourself, or B, this is the most disgusting thing you could ever suggest. I was like, it's really not.
Yeah.
It's really, really not. I think it's a very viable thing to ask. I think it was just, I do not understand the strength of reaction versus the stimulus that caused the reaction in the first place.
Well, there's a lot of angry, frustrated people out there with no outlet, and they're spending some time on Nextdoor. And to be honest, a lot of those people are probably shouting on Facebook and other places as well.
Other platforms are available.
But people do, people react over, you know, really minor stuff, like somebody will come on and they will decide to make a helpful post about remembering to feed the birds and making sure that the water for the birds is, you know, not frozen. So there was, this is a post recently, a man came on and said, remember to use proper bird seed and bread for the birds and make sure the water is not frozen in the morning for the birds because the birds are struggling and the birds will...
Think about the birds.
Yeah. And the birds need this and they need us to do this. So let's do it for the birds.
The birds are the bees of winter.
Yes. Yeah.
Because in the summer, it's all about the bees and the water and the sugar and the birds is the winter.
Yeah. So first of all, he was immediately criticised for saying bread. So he had to edit his post.
That, yeah.
Right.
So she said, I was like, no, bread.
Yeah. So remember to put out proper bird seed in brackets, all caps, not bread. As I had previously said, and you know, water and all that kind of stuff. And so basically the comments were, not bread, bread is terrible for birds and blah blah blah, and it's too filling and they won't find other
food. Sometimes pigeons explode.
And then there was people saying, you know, I think everybody needs to be aware that if you put bird seed out, you're going to attract rats, and we have enough of a rat problem here. So somebody else helpfully then shares, actually, in, you know, the Range or B&M Bargains, they sell bird seed that's spicy and the birds can't taste it, but the rats and other vermin hate it.
Oh my God.
So, you know, amazing. It's just, it's where people go to like be know-it-alls about how to live better in your house and how to do the right thing in your house and just the surrounding area, you know, complain about others doing it not the right way.
I was just thinking that you think bird shit is bad enough. Imagine chili bird shit falling on you from above, like where it burns your eyes a bit. Good grief.
Yeah. So, I mean, I will do my fine poem about next door. I'll save that for next time. But in the meantime, I think we can agree that, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. There's nothing wrong with anybody on it. But, you know, they have some strong views and they are about sharing them.
So to review, today we talked about the experience of freezing. I also really do want to plug that show on Paramount Plus. It was excellent.
Yeah.
It's called Flatshare. It's only 6 episodes. It was very, very good. I'm going to make a really concerted effort to watch more stuff that your girl is in because she was fantastic.
Okay, cool.
So yeah, about freezing and just a little bit more kindness. Actually, I feel like the theme of this episode was just a bit of kindness towards yourself. There was, you know, a real kind of congruent theme through this. And then Emma shared the trauma of her lack of sense of direction.
Yeah, still feel inadequate. But yeah. I'll try to be kinder to myself about it.
Try to be kinder to yourself because everybody gets lost sometimes.
Okay, thanks.
Sounds like something that Peyton Sawyer would say. And then we talked a little bit about people eating all manner of a bull's innards. And people then, what happens when people ingest the wrong sort of things like magnesium citrate and have a long conversation with their toilet. And then we just talked a little bit about next door and how some people can have real vitriol about things that do not seem to really equate to vitriol, but yet vitriol happens anyway. And Emma has promised for some sort of fine poetry.
Yes, I will do a fine poem with words from next door for next time.
When you said fine poem, in my mind I saw, for whatever reason, like a glass bottle that you found on the beach, and then I was like, how does this connect to next door?
You know your man, the comedian, he did it was quite performative actually as well. He found all the people that he could find that had the same name as him. What do you call him? Gorman?
Oh,
something Gorman. I thought
you meant Joe Lycett.
No, I can't Google anything because my phone doesn't work out here. But anyway, he does a thing with fine poem and like on the comment section of different things.
Very good.
So it gives you a bit of a snapshot of the overall thing. But actually what I think is quite good about this format that we've just developed in the last 3 episodes is that the things that we talk about, I feel like are, you know, the very, like, a breadth of human experience, like a lot of people will be able to identify with them. But then there's some more extreme stuff on TikTok, isn't there? That's more the extreme end of the human experience, like wondering what brings people to those things that they're doing.
Yes.
And then next door is the kind of like, It's the curtain twitching of, yes. It's like, what's wrong with my neighbours?
What's my neighbours doing?
You know, is there anything wrong with my neighbours? Mm-hmm. No, not really. They're mostly, you know, bored and angry, really, I think, is that's it.
I mean, bored and angry, but nothing really wrong with them.
No. And there's nothing wrong with you, Danny.
Oh, and Emma, there is nothing wrong with you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.